Black Lives Matter. At the Dropped Again podcast, we wholeheartedly support the Black Lives Matter movement. As individuals of color ourselves, we are allies to our Black brothers and sisters. The time for change is now.
Oh dear.
It's a straightforward catch. Catch you'll see in the playground. A 10-year-old, 11-year-old will catch that and up with their eyes shut.
There goes. Dropped it again. Can you believe that?
3, 2, 1. Let's do this. Welcome to episode 4 of Dropped Again. As always, I have with me Shahid Keshwani. Shady, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing excellent, brother. Thanks for asking. Had to do my part today. I threw on my Tupac toque, sorry, not my toque, my Tupac hoodie. Try saying that, Tupac toque, 5 times fast. But my Tupac hoodie, and went out and did a little bit of my part. And obviously the Black Lives Matter is a very, very important issue that we've been facing for the last 400 years. It's not an American problem. It's a global problem. I think it needs to be addressed, and it is. And I don't think that we should stop until there is change, and that's like through the justice system. Government has to put laws in place where color and race, and especially when it applies to Black people and what they've been going through over the last, you know, forever, feels like that's got to be over with, man. And I was just trying to show my support to that, and will continue to do so as I always have with the way I go about my business,
bro. Absolutely. And I think the major thing to note there is that it isn't a U.S. problem. It's not even a U.S., the Southern States problem. This is a global issue that we all have to deal with and that we all need to speak out on. And the fact of the matter is that it isn't just one person or two people or three people. It's not one bad egg or whatever the saying goes. It's a systemic issue through and through that has to change. And I'm going to thank you on behalf of everybody for going out and protesting and obviously supporting the movement. But again, I think the murder of George Floyd, it just shed even more light into the systemic problems that happen throughout the world and specifically in the United States. And there has to be a change that's made. So the other thing is it's crazy that there's protests going on globally, right? Like, there's a protest in Palestine and they've got their own issues, and there's a protest going on there. I've seen protests in Germany, the UK, Australia, and you and I both know through traveling through cricket, racism is everywhere.
So like we get to travel the world, you know, playing for Canada, and you see how racism is in other parts of the world. Like, you know, we've been to South Africa and Namibia's and even Kenya's, and then, you know, in Trinidad and Ghana, like, so I can, you know, those are just off the top of my head. But like even our own experiences, my own experiences, I was in Sri Lanka with Henry, and I know he's a future guest of ours, and I'm going to kind of leave it to him to shed light on that. Actually, I think it would be very interesting to hear how he felt being in Sri Lanka. Like, I was there with him, but I kind of looked like I fit in. And then, you know, being able to relate to that myself in a way in terms of how I grew up playing hockey and being obviously the only colored. I think, no, actually, there's a few, like, there's a couple Black guys in the league, but definitely the only brown guy. And so I can relate to that a little bit. And even to go further than that is, like, so, like, me, like, I'm always, like, trying to be, like, or look to be, like, accepted, right? So, like, I find myself whenever I'm in heavily white environments, you know how you, like, always give the half-smile nod? You're just looking for that white person, just kind of approve, and like you'll feel you feel their energy, right? So I always do the half smile nod, and that gives me a pretty good glimpse right away as to how receptive they'll be of me, and that's kind of one point I wanted to make. Another one is like how people like dress. So like here I am today wearing my Tupac hoodie, and I always sort of dress just kind of jogging pants, and that's my thing. And you know, I'm never afraid to express myself. And I think that all the like excuses and things that people talk about when it relates to Black culture, right? Hip hop music and that, all that stuff ties in. So it's not just like the small things. And so my point is that educating yourself, being able to travel is something that is a privilege, and you know, you need money to do that. So I'm not saying go and travel the world and learn. You can learn on Google, right? I was just with my niece. She was watching them Sesame Street. They're on Sesame Street now. They're like, want to learn something? Press this button on your smartphone. And like Elmo is showing you how it's done. So like if Elmo can figure it out, guys, like go and look in the mirror, learn something about these cultures, about the history, and make a difference just within your own little small bubble. I think social media, we're all looking, we're, Jesus, this is Palestine. Like what is, focus on your own neighbors, the people who you interact with every day. Make a difference in their sort of perspective by having difficult conversations and making them understand. And even for us, we have to understand more as well. So I think that is a huge thing that I'm seeing is like, oh, wow, like, people are doing these huge, huge things. Like, dude, your life is not that big. Narrow it down. I know social media is a real, like it gets me going. Like sometimes I think I'm there, but no, talk to your neighbors. Like talk to the people who you interact with every day, educate, have the conversations. And I think it'll make a world of difference just in terms of how we look at things. So there needs to be improvement fast.
Absolutely. And I think education is a huge part of that, right? You spoke about Sesame Street. Sesame Street was on CNN the other day. Might have even been last night where they were talking to kids on CNN because they know that the parents are watching CNN. Well, the kids are sitting right there. And a great quote that I heard, and it was from an NFL player who stated that he was talking to his coach just in terms of the what's going on. And his coach stated, well, only Disney at our house right now. We're keeping our kids as far away from it as possible, trying to make sure that, and the coach is obviously a white man. There's only 4 black coaches, only 2 black GMs in the NFL, which is crazy. So the coach is a white male, keeping his kids away. This individual who's a black male said, that's privilege. I don't have that luxury. I mean, that speaks volumes as to the issue at hand here is there isn't enough education. We as a society, whether you're white, brown, black, whoever you are, we're all one human race at the end of the day. And we all need to do better day in, day out, look in the mirror. How can I be a better person? How can I be a better person to my neighbors? How can I be a better person to my family, my friends, and so forth? And that's how the world's going to change. And then our leaders have to definitely step up and make a change because this is a systemic problem at the end of the day. We talked about stereotypes about people dressing. We all have them. You see somebody dressed, you know, in a Tupac hoodie, you're going to look like, well, what's the message that guy's trying to send out there, right? So I completely agree with you. Moving on to the topic of the day, and racism actually was brought up in the interview that we had with our guest on the podcast today, our very own John Davison, who's living in Australia now, brought up racism. So what an interview that was, Shahid. I was super excited for this one, man. I was up all night. I couldn't wait for this interview to get going. And it was early in the morning for JD. His alarm kept going off through the entire interview.
Yeah, I think he was trying to run his hair through his hands, through his hair there in the morning. He just turned 50 years old. So bright and early for JD with the alarm. I think he plays a lot of golf and stuff too. Like I think his kid plays some good bit of golf. I know I was playing earlier this week. My wife got me a new pair of golf pants, which have definitely helped my game. I just want to shout out my wife for getting those because I get absolutely roasted by the boys about my apparel.
Well, you wear track pants every single time you play golf. You literally wear sweats every single day. So it's great to see that you now have a pair of golf pants.
Yeah, no, I was waiting. I was just waiting till I consistently shot under the 90s to actually think about the golf attire. And you would know, like from my cricket and stuff like that, like equipment has never been my strong suit. So that's kind of how I roll. But I look unbelievable in these pants. They're like fitting tight. Oh, anyways, Davo, a lot of the stories that he told in this interview, man, like I kind of knew about from before, but then there was a lot of them that I didn't know about either. Like the details that he goes into relative to some stories and the amount of names that he drops, like you guys just wait for this interview. Like I think he let us know basically everybody who's in the Australian Hall of Fame. And I think like every guy who was in the Maple Leaf, like 69 Stanley Cup winning team there.
67.
Yeah, I know. I 69, you know. So yeah, no. So that was that was pretty cool. But then within all those names, you'll hear some big, big names who, like, you're going, oh shit, he played with them. And one thing that, you know, he didn't talk about, because he's not going to pump his own tires too much, was like, dude, this guy like was a world-class off spinner, world-class. Shane Warne was in his way of becoming one of the Australian test spinners. He was like, he went to the Australian Academy at a young age. So he was one of the top players in Australia, and he was an off spinner. So to be an off spinner in Australia coming up, like, this guy was unbelievable. You should have seen this guy field too. Like, a lot of you guys didn't even see him play. He was world class. Like, he could have played on any of the other teams at that time, because Australia was so dominant. I think Australia, every first class team in Australia could have beat any other team in the world during those years. And there's no question about that. So, you know, for me, obviously being able to experience him and his skills, and again, I loved him for just being cool, always allowing me to sort of be myself, and he never really saw any issues with that. Loves a beer, loves to train hard, and those are the big assets, the big things that Canada cricket surely used. No, I wouldn't say used. Like, he was there, he played for Canada. But he put us on the map 100%. I think Cricket Canada has a lot to be thankful for in that regard. You know, like, he's obviously a legend in Canadian cricket. So I think he's like also totally responsible for like the success of Nathan Lyon in terms of coaching. Is that right? Like, did he work with him? Like, I heard, like, I don't know specifically, but I'm pretty sure he like really worked with Nathan Lyon for a long time.
Yeah. Well, he speaks about it in the interview. Once Shane Warne retired, he was a part of that search for the next Shane Warne. And it was a pretty tough gig, but
I was super ripped, man. So like,
anyway, I've got it all memorized. I've listened to that interview about 20 times already, and I'll listen to it again once it goes live, which we're going to share with you all in a second. So yeah, so Nathan Lyon, Jason Krejcia, Nathan Horitz, all these spinners that Australia tried, even Steve Smith, right? He was responsible in working with all those guys. And Nathan Lyon arguably is the best off spinner of all time. Our very own. I'd love to call him our very own, because Toronto Cricket Club guy, Canadian cricket, like, he's the one that got me into cricket. So he's our guy, and our guy is responsible for if not the greatest off spinner of all time.
Yeah, man. He's a pretty cool guy too. I got to give it to him. You know me, I don't like to pump guys' tires too much, but obviously this is a Canada cricket legend. And I think everybody will have an amazing time listening to this interview. And like, before we get in the interview, I'm at this protest, right? So there's two things I just wanted to add, because I thought they were super funny. So I'm at this protest, and then, so one of the ladies is like in the vicinity, whatever. She's like, oh, you know, we want to help these African Americans here. And then this other person was like, you know that we're in Canada, lady. Like, she's like, yeah, but we shouldn't be calling them black and stuff. So this is a conversation opener too. Like, black people, it's okay to call them black people, right? We're brown people, white people. Like, this sort of, like, this is so much further and way more like beyond that stuff. Don't get your names twisted and think that, oh, this guy's going to think about that. But then also shout out to the guy who, I swear to God, no lie, I heard him in the background. Sachin with the protesting. So obviously there's some Indian guys just having some fun within the mix. And I heard a whole bunch of other stuff, but that just kind of, I don't know how Sachin thing came in my head, but while I was out there, there was a guy doing that. So I thought that was funny. Should have brought it up. And back to you, RC.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for the Sachin chance. There was actually guys, I was just at the park, and there was guys playing cricket there too. So cricket's all around. And you know what? Once you're done playing cricket, listen, put in the Dropped Again podcast on your way home and listen to us and listen to this interview coming up. So this interview is brought to you by the Bat Clinic. Shout out to the Bat Clinic. You can find them at the_bat_clinic on Instagram, and you get 10% off with every order when you use the promo code Dropped Again. And now we welcome on a very special guest. I'm honored to have him here with us today. I spoke about it in one of the first episodes, but one of the main reasons that I got into cricket was the 2003 World Cup. And the next guest that we have on definitely played a huge role in that. He was born in Campbell River, British Columbia, to Australian parents that were teaching on a one-year exchange. But it wouldn't be until his late 20s that he would make his return to Canada after playing state cricket for Victoria and to spend the Australian winter playing cricket up north. Didn't take him long to put the maple leaf on his chest, however, as he helped Canada qualify for the 2003 World Cup, where he blitzed the fastest World Cup 100 off 67 balls. But he wasn't done. Many people forget he also made 75 against New Zealand, and the 50 came off 25 balls. He would be named captain of Canada after the World Cup and went to take on the best figures in a first-class match anywhere in the world since Jim Laker in 1956. I could go on and on and on about all the accolades, but it's time to talk to the man himself. He is John Michael Davison. Welcome to the show, Davo.
Hey, boys. How you going?
Very well. How you doing?
All right. All right. Nice to catch up after a long time.
Davo, it's Shady here. I got to tell you and the fans right off the bat, buddy, the anxiety of all day leading up to this, I had to just smoke a huge fatty before this. So I'm excited to have you on. Thanks for doing this, buddy.
No problem. You obviously haven't changed much then, Shady.
Listen, mate, if it was anyone who kind of paved the way for me to kind of go out and just express myself, it was definitely you. I wish that Canada cricket would have understood me the way that you did during my career.
Oh, that's nice, mate. Unfortunate that you probably didn't get the support you probably needed, but that's sort of the way I played and the way I coach. You know, I'm still involved in coaching, and getting young kids to express themselves is a big part of my coaching philosophy.
Yeah, so I mean, speaking on that, like, kind of right off the bat for me was the introduction to JD, and I know we'll get into that a little bit more sort of as we go, but for me, we're obviously a huge mentor, and I'll never forget sort of 2002 early stages where I just met you, and it was kind of the net sessions at Kasra Sports where you kind of really helped me with the craft of off spin. And I remember it was you, me, and Joe Harris spot bowling and bowling in the Kasra nets, and I'll never forget that, man. So it was awesome to be able to have that experience with you.
That's great, man. It's amazing when you go through your life and you're just doing normal things that you think are normal, but to be able to influence people and to not realize that you are having influence on people is huge, you know. So to look back and reflect on that sort of stuff and hear those sort of comments gives your life more meaning, I suppose.
Well, you've definitely influenced a lot of people in your great life, Davo. The one thing I want to say is happy belated birthday, first and foremost. I think it was May 9th. Is that correct? The big 5-0?
Yeah. Raised the bat on Saturday. Probably a good, well, not a great time to have your milestone birthday when things are in partial lockdown, but probably saved me a fair bit of money in terms of how many people I was allowed to have around. So we celebrated with some good friends in Brisbane who we've met since we've been here. So it was a good day.
Amazing. Well, I'm sure there's some reflecting going down memory lane then. We're going to take you down memory lane here today as well. So I hope you're ready. Where I want to start off is I read somewhere that, you didn't know about, or you didn't know the potential about playing for Canada, but there was a gentleman that played for Fiji.
Yep, Neil Maxwell.
And that led you to write an email to the Canadian Cricket Association at the time. Is that correct?
Well, this is going to show how old I am. I think it was before the time of email, so I think I penned a letter. I found the I'm not sure how I found the address, and that's probably why I didn't get a reply. I probably didn't get to the right person or the right address. But I wrote a letter and sent it to Canadian Cricket Association when I was 18, I reckon. Neil Maxwell was playing for Fiji, who was 2 or 3 years older than me. And I thought, geez, that sounds pretty cool. Young bloke from Australia looking to do a bit of traveling on someone else's expense. So I thought I'll write a letter. And then the reply from Canadian Cricket took about 10 years. So I got an email. I think it was Howard, actually, Howard Petrou. I think he sent me an email in the late 90s asking if I'd ever thought about playing for Canada.
So, mate, I think old Howard Petrouk was the guy who had the first computer ever.
Yeah, that's right. He probably sent the first email ever. Yeah.
So you get this email. It says, are you interested? What's going through your mind at this stage? Obviously, you probably hadn't thought about it for a decade.
No, so my cricket cricket had sort of taken off. I was playing first class cricket for Victoria at the time. And, you know, I was playing reasonable cricket, but, you know, the Australian team was probably our best team in the history of the game. You know, the Steve Waugh era, you know, Warren McGrath, all those guys. And I thought, you know, it's probably not going to get a game for Australia. So, you know, what are the other avenues of playing? I knew there was a World Cup qualifier coming up. And so I thought, yeah, let's have a crack. You know, I was single at the time, and, you know, traveling was something that I wanted to do. So I thought, oh, well, let's go. And yeah, what happened from there? Andrew Bracht, who was a member at the Toronto Cricket Skating Curling Club, was traveling in Australia at the time. And I think Howard or the club, or I think it was the club, I think when I say the club, the Toronto Cricket Club, asked if Andrew could come down to the MCG and you know, watch me play and meet me. And so that I met Bracky at the MCG after a day's play I can't remember who we're playing, but we're sitting out in front of the members at the MCG having a chat, and you know, a great friendship kicked off there with Bracky. You know, I spent a lot of time with him when I was in Toronto, and one of the many people who Canadian people who I met and have became great mates with.
Dave-O, you're a super humble guy. You've always been, and kind of the Australian way, but like, dude, you were playing first class cricket at a time. You went to the Australian Cricket Academy. Like, I know some of the guys that obviously you were playing against at that time and with at that time. They're some of the greatest cricketers of all time. And I'm going to let you speak on that for a little bit more, because I just want people to kind of realize and know sort of where you were at that time. I mean, so you were accepting at that time that Shane Warne is the spinner for Australia?
Yeah, right. So my intake at the what was called the Cricket Academy in 93, which was probably the fourth intake, I think it started in 89. My intake was Ricky Ponting and Michael DiVenuto from Tasmania, Brad Hodge and Simon Cook, who was a fast bowler who played for Australia with the Victorians, Jimmy Marr and Wade Seckham, who Wade Seckham played over 100 games for Queensland is now the Queensland coach, and Jimmy Marr played one day cricket for Australia, Glenn McGrath, and then two other guys whose names aren't probably as familiar, Jason Armberger and Sean Bradstreet. Sean Bradstreet he had a few injuries, but was a very good cricketer. Jason Armberger played a lot of first-class cricket for Victoria, and myself. I was based in Sydney then too. Western Australians were Murray Goodwin, who played a shitload of cricket around first-class cricket around the world, county cricket, and played for WA, and obviously represented Zimbabwe and did well. And David Fitzgerald, who's still involved in cricket. He's a talent manager for the Western Australia Cricket Association. Yeah, so that was a bloody good year, and we played some great cricket. We played against New Zealand. Each year they used to play against the touring team. The first game was against the touring team, and we beat New Zealand in a one day match at North Sydney Oval. And then yeah, that era of, you know, those guys coming through the system, and the Australian team at that time through the 90s was, you know, it was a ridiculous team, and the depth of talent around Australia that guys who were scoring unbelievable amount of runs, like Martin Love and Stuart Law and Darren Lehman and Jamie Siddons and all these guys who, you know, in any other era would have been, you know, one of our better players. You know, it was a good time to play. It was a good time to play in Australia, but it was a tough time to get higher honours. But
yeah, you can't change that.
When you, so obviously that, you know, you come to Canada, you're here, you've established yourself sort of as a cricket pro with a club, and then it's Canada cricket time. My, like for us, and we spoke to Ash about who played a huge role in Canada cricket at that time, and it was Jeff Thomas. Did you know Jeff? Had you played against Jeff? I know that he was a first-class player as well. What was your sort of relationship with him in Australia? And then coming to Canada, how did that sort of fit with their, that, what was the culture sort of like at that time when you came in?
Yeah. Yeah. So Tomo had been the pro over there, and I can't remember if he was the coach when I first got there. So he coached the first qualifier, didn't he? That 2001, was it 2001?
Yeah, 2000.
Yeah, he coached that. So yeah, he must have been. Oh no, Kirsten was there, wasn't he?
No, like you're talking about the cricket club. I'm talking about Cricket Canada. Like Tomo was there.
Oh yeah, Tomo was definitely there. Yeah, Tomo was definitely there.
Yeah, and then he became the national team coach.
Yeah, you start to lose your memory a bit when you turn 50, mate.
Hey, that's all right. We understand.
Bear with me. Yeah, so Tomo, I reckon I'd played maybe a couple of second 11 games or something like that against him, but I lived with a guy called Matthew Mott, who's now the Cricket Australia women's team coach, and he's coached various first-class teams and whatnot. So he was a Queenslander and had moved to Victoria, and so we were sharing flat in Melbourne. And Motty actually was the best man at my wedding, so you know, he's a good mate of mine. And he knew Tomo well, and you know, so I sort of felt as though I knew Tomo pretty well because I'd heard lots of stories about him and what he got up to on tours and things like that. So when I arrived there, I think you know we got on really well straight away. It was, you know, as you said, you know, laid back Aussies. There's quite a few of us. Tomo's definitely one of them. You know, he was great mates with Joe Harris, who was the captain at the time. And so, yeah, after, you know, we'd have training and slip down to the pub down the road just to, what was it called? The one just around the corner from the club.
It was the Firkin, like, but listen, like.
Yeah, the Firkin was the first stop. And then we'd go down to the Duke. Was it the Duke?
The Duke of Kent.
Yeah. So there was. There was plenty of beers, you know. Harris was, if anything, a very influential leader. So he'd drag us all out. So it was good. But then, in terms of the culture, you know, I think I always had I enjoyed myself, but I think I always had a good work ethic, training. So I think I, you know, helped Tomo in that regard in terms of, you know, creating an environment that was fun, but you know, one that we were expected to work hard. You know, off the field there was other challenges, but you know, with the administration and whatnot, and you know, how it all eventually panned out with Jeff was hugely disappointing for him, but also for us, because I think we would have had a wonderful experience as a team under Jeff Thomas if he'd gone to the World Cup as he was meant to and had every right to.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we've talked about in length, is and she spoke about it as well, about Jeff Thomas, the influence that he had, not only just on the local cricket side, but also at the national level. And Ashish mentioned that, you know, the team wouldn't have potentially not even qualified for the World Cup had not been Tomo's influence. I've got two questions for you just in regards to that. So number one, a lot of the guys around that time, I can name some names, but I'm just going to leave those out. But some of the West Indians and some of the other guys, A, weren't as fit physically, but also the work ethic might not have been there. What challenges did you guys have at that time to kind of push those guys to get them to another level that they possibly didn't even believe that they had? And the second question is just around Jeff. Like, how did you find out that he wasn't going to be traveling with you guys to the World Cup? And then how did you react to that?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, the biggest chat, like I was a professional cricketer when I came into that setup. So I had the time and the desire to be a good cricketer, or to be as well. My livelihood depended on me being a good cricketer. So I obviously had to work hard to maintain the level that I wanted to be at. The challenges for the rest, or the majority of the rest, was that everyone had a job and, you know, they were time poor. And so it was, you know, cricket for pretty much everyone there was a recreation. And so to motivate the guys to go to the next level was really hard, because they had to find the time to do it. And I suppose that was always I think I was tough on a lot of my teammates during games. If, you know, if there was misfields or things like that, I didn't cope with that very well. And, you know, but I didn't cope with it well because I expected higher standards. And if people weren't looking to, if I didn't see people putting the effort in, then I couldn't cope with that, or I wouldn't cop it. But if I saw people putting effort in, then you'd cop those sort of things. So it was just trying to take us to the next level. Particularly training before we go into World Cups and things like that, I didn't want us to embarrass ourselves. You know, I wanted us to be able to put on a good show. And you know, you're on the world stage. You don't want to be looking like club cricketers when you're on the world stage. And then in terms of, I can't remember how it worked with Tomo, if we were over there.
No, it was, I think it was about 6 weeks before Devo. And I actually remember because we were at Casra Sports for training like normal leading up to that. And for me, I was just a young guy bowling. But I remember the scene. I remember the vibe I just remember the room, like the room being the nets that day. And it was a dark, a very dark situation. And, you know, I think that will sort of trigger your memory a little bit, but like Ash said it, you know, you guys were gutted and
now I don't think I was there. I think I came directly from Australia. Yeah, I did. I came directly from Australia to South Africa. So I would have been in Australia when we found out. I was definitely gutted, particularly for Tomo, because I knew the work he'd put in. You know, we'd gone through an emotional qualifier that, you know, we just scraped in. And, you know, the celebrations after that, knowing that we were going to go, were huge. And it was a huge moment for all involved. And to have coached through that roller coaster would have been a bit of a nightmare for Tomo. You know, a fun nightmare, but an absolute roller coaster. Yeah, and then Jeff Edwards to accept an invitation from West Indies Cricket to you know, offer Gus Logie, who none of us knew. Well, we knew who he was, but none of us had worked with him or didn't know what he was like. And I just thought that was a real kick in the guts. You know, it was Canadian cricket not honouring a contract and taking a coach for free to a World Cup. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, didn't sit well with any of it. Oh, it didn't sit well with the majority of us. I think the West Indian guys were probably excited to be working with someone who had played cricket for the West Indies. But, you know, the guys who had worked with Tomo realised or knew that he was a good coach. He was a steadying influence, you know, over particularly me. I was an emotional sort of cricketer, and Tomo was, you know, very level-headed. And so, you know, it would have been great to have shared that World Cup experience with him.
Yeah, I think, but at the same time, Devo, like, and this is probably, and again, like, I know this story. A lot of people don't know this story. That played a huge role when that day came, and it was Canada versus West Indies. And take us through what was going on. Like, okay, we saw the sixes, and like, fuck, man, it was unbelievable. I remember where I was with my family. Like, we're just like, what is this fucking guy doing walking down the wicket and all that stuff? And that was awesome. And, you know, we've all YouTubed it. I think I've YouTubed that maybe 100 times. It's unbelievable. But what was the mindset? Is there a story behind that, Hunter? Is there a backstory? Is there anything interesting?
Yeah, there is. So in the lead up to – so Sanjay Thurasingham was like an unbelievable cricketer. Like, he was such a talent. He probably wasn't as fit as he could have been. Well, he definitely wasn't. But as an athlete, he was a javelin thrower and a good athlete. And as a junior, as a younger guy, played first class cricket in Sri Lanka. And I don't know how many people saw him bowling at full flight, but he was a bloody good bowler. He was a world class bowler and great fielder. Could handle a bat. I know Mark Waugh was very impressed with him when he faced him in the Commonwealth Games, and people would have seen him bowl against West Indies A at King City, and the slips were standing beyond the 30-meter circle. It was unbelievable, and so he was a big part in us making that World Cup team. He had a little bit of a sore back, which we had a massage therapist on tour with us, and he spent a bit of time with Sanjay, and all of a sudden, leading into the West Indies game, well, probably 4 days before, they were saying, "Oh, Sanjay can't play," and I'm like, "Are you kidding me? He's one of our best players." I always wanted to. I didn't see the World Cup as a, even though you had 15 people on tour, I didn't see it as a participation event. I saw it as you play your best team, we put on our best performance. If you're not good enough to be in the best 11, so be it. The Australian team does it all the time. They'll have 15 people on tour, 4 people won't play. And that's just how it is. You play your best team.
I know all about that, buddy. I've been on more tours than I've played fucking games. So I know all about that. You need a couple glue guys in the team.
Yeah, that's right. And I know for a fact that the Cricket Australia will go, all right, who are going to be our best reserves? Who are the people who are going to help out the team and be able to cope with not playing? But anyway, that's beside the point. So we're leading into this game, and Sanjay's saying to me, "I want to play. I'm at a World Cup. I want to play." And so I was like, "Well, give him a fitness test. If he can pass a fitness test, let him play. Anyway, the morning before the game, they gave him like a fitness test, apparently, which he apparently didn't pass. And Sanjay was really upset. I confronted Gus Logie and I said, why aren't we playing Sanjay? And he said, "Oh, he's been ruled out." And I said, "By who?" And he goes, "Oh, Milton, who was the massage therapist." I said, "Well, he's a massage therapist. What's he doing ruling people out of a game? If Sanjay thinks he can play, let him play." And Gus Logie basically called me a racist and said, "You don't," and he was talking about, I think Nicky Eiffel was coming into the team, and Nicky was a good club batsman. Like he'd scored some reasonable runs in the Toronto League, but if you threw him a cricket ball, there was every chance he was going to drop it. His bowling wasn't going to cut it at the World Cup. Gus Logie was basically said, you don't rate these other guys. And I said, "Well, mate," you've seen a lot of cricket. You can't tell me that he's as good a cricketer as Sanjay. And then he basically said I was a racist, and I was like, "Oh, fuck this. I'm not copping this bullshit. I could be back in Australia playing first class cricket." So I said, "I'm fucking out." And I went back to the changing rooms. What was the manager's name?
Karam Gopal Singh.
Yeah, Karam. Karam was in the change rooms. I said, "Fuck this, mate. I'm not playing. Book me a flight home. I'm done." And he's like, What's going on? I told him, I said, "I'm not going to cop this. I've been called a racist. I've got mates all around the world. I've got, mates in this team who aren't white." I was the only white guy there, I think. So Karam's like, didn't know what was going on. And then Harris comes in, tries to cool me down and whatnot. And so I basically wouldn't, look at Gus Logie or whatever after that. I was ropeable with it. So we go into the game. Well, we win the toss and bat. I just put my gear on and walked out to the front of the change rooms and just prepared myself out there. We'd done a yoga session actually, or a breathing session with someone, and I was like doing some breathing exercises that we had done with this breathing coach or yoga person.
And so, yeah, just went out to bat and managed to focus myself. It was a great batting wicket. I remember hitting one, hitting a defensive shot that hit right in the middle of the bat off Merv Dillon early on in the piece, and thought, wow, this wicket's good and I'm seeing the ball well. Yeah, and things just went from there. But when I got my 100, I think that there'll be a photo somewhere that you see Michael Slater and all those guys kissing the emblem, kissing the badge on their helmet. I actually tucked the helmet under my arm because I couldn't cope with what happened at the beginning of the game. And I suppose it was a reflection on the administration getting rid of Tomo, having that run in with Gus Logie. And so I was like, fuck that, I'm going to tuck my helmet under my arm and just raise the bat. But yeah, you know, I think that's one thing that I would pride myself on, looking back on what I did. I tried to stick up for my teammates, particularly in that Canadian setup where I felt as though I had a voice. I felt as though, you know, I could use my position as more of a senior player in the team to help out my teammates.
Would you say that it was ironic that it was against the West Indies at that point, just with everything that's gone on and, you know, Korea Canada wanting to get closer to the West Indies? Was there some irony in that, or do you think that was, I mean, a gift from God? What was it?
Oh, I think that was just a coincidence. I suppose you could look at it and say it was ironic, but I think the West Indies would have gone into that game thinking that it was just, they were going to roll us for, you know, less than 100. And it was interesting to, and I think I commented to media afterwards that, you know, they had no plans. Like they had at one stage, they were allowed to have four out and they only had three out and they were going at 10 and over. So it was interesting, you know, I think Michael Holding was commentating and said, I think that they left their brains on the bus or something like that. But it was good. We did that a few times. We had a few games where we put some big teams under pressure, and it was great. It was a great feeling to be able to, you know, put, you know, some of the better cricketers in the world, to see them under pressure for, you know, we probably couldn't maintain it for the whole game, but to have snippets and moments in the game where you put teams under pressure was a good feeling.
I think it played a huge role in Canada cricket from a youngster's perspective. It was a really sort of hot time to be a young cricketer in Canada. Obviously, I was one of them, and I know RC was one of them as well. It did a lot for us, and I know that the standard of cricket in Canada after that 2003 World Cup really jumped. A lot of the teams were bringing in pros and guys who were first-class cricketers coming in as well. The wickets were all playing on turf, and it was a fantastic time and experience. Yeah. What did you feel after that 2003 World Cup? I know that we played a season or maybe two together with the Toronto Cricket Club after that.
Yep.
That sort of did for me. But what was your take at that time on domestic cricket in Canada and sort of the opportunities for youngsters coming up?
Yeah, I thought there was some really good cricket played in the Toronto TCA tournament competition. And yeah, you're right. The wickets at King City, and unfortunately a couple of the other wickets weren't maintained at Ross Lord, and what was the other one? It was Ajax or something?
Sunnybrook.
Yeah, there was a couple that weren't able to maintain, which was a little bit disappointing. But you know, the wickets at King City were really good. The Toronto one was great as always. And look, I don't think it's a bad thing that, you know, it's not all played on turf. I think, you know, you learn different ways of coping, and, you know, on some of the matting wickets and things like that, different ways of playing and different ways of scoring or different ways of problem solving. And they turned a heap too, so that was always fun. But yeah, there was some good cricket being played, and one of the things that really stood out to me was the tribalism of the TCA competition. Like there was some really aggressive cricket played. Like you know, it was like warfare against some clubs, which was, you know, it was great to play cricket that was passionate, and you know, I was all for that, you know, and I loved getting into contest. probably shit myself a couple of times against Centurions when the gangsters were in the car park and whatnot. But, you know, so be it. After the game, it was all good. You know, Sanjay or someone who you knew well from the Canadian setup would, you know, introduce you to some of the boys who were, you know, sending threats, yelling out threats to you during the game. And, you know, you'd have a beer and a little bit of food that they, you know, the Sri Lankan, the Centurion team always had a bit of a barbecue going on and whatnot. So, mate, it was good times. I enjoyed it.
We spoke about that in one of the last episodes. That still goes on to this day. There's certain teams where the umpires are shaking. There's an appeal, and that, you know, that hand's going up because you let the last one go. So that still happens today. So I'm glad it was going on at that time too.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, to play cricket passionately, it's the only way to play, I think. But then to, you know, be able to break things down and have a beer or you know, something to eat with your opposition after the game and have a laugh about things was, you know, it's great. You know, I remember guys like Brian Rajadurai, who was, you know, such a mild-mannered guy off the field, but then on the field, he'd, you know, his eyes would be spinning when he was playing against you, and he was a bloody good cricketer. And I think we were fortunate to have Joe Harris as a captain too, because he was so good at socializing with people and having a laugh with people. And I think I think Harris had a bigger influence than me on a lot of the young guys like Ash and Zubin and those type of guys. I think you see their personalities and the way they played the game and the way they interacted with their teammates. I think, you know, I can see Harris and his influence on those guys for sure.
Yeah, that influence still plays a huge role now. Like, for me, I was just younger than that, but definitely came up under that exact same culture that was passed down, right? Like, I mean, Harris stopped,
yeah,
still around, and then towards Zubin and Ash, and then sort of towards me and with the Toronto Cricket Club, and we still sort of go with that same culture. Like, Nitish is one who's grown up under that culture, and so we still keep that alive. Like, it's hard on the field, it's hard in training, and it's even harder off the field.
Yeah, and it's amazing that the influence that a sporting club and a sporting environment can have on shaping people, isn't it? It's like, to be able to see that passed on through generations, you know, the influence of, and I don't know who was, you know, I there was probably before Harris, there was probably guys too that were, I don't know who was before Harris at the club who captained, and I'm sure it was the same, you know, that environment at the cricket club. You know, it was such a beautiful place to play cricket, and the, you know, the club and all the different members you know, I think that, you know, we were definitely breaking down the barriers of the different members of the club, and they became interested in the team and whatnot, probably because they saw us having such a good time.
Or maybe because they saw that one white guy on the national team.
God, you reckon that broke down the barrier?
Absolutely, man. Possibly. You're the one dominating the scene, man.
As I said, you know, if you know, have a beer and you just talk to people, that's pretty good times, I reckon.
You're always really easy to approach. And I know, like, when you saw a good cricketer, you really, like, sort of latched onto them. And again, like, I still kind of reap those sort of rewards and try to pass those on as well. And with regards, obviously, to spin bowling and just cricket in general, but spin bowling is your craft.
Yeah.
Everything about your craft was sort of perfection. I remember the action and the release and all that stuff that we went through, and the details around that were unbelievable. And some of that stuff, like learning the arm ball from you, and that was huge for me. And I remember going to India, and like, that arm ball was something that they weren't really seeing. So, like, I remember a coach in academy that went to India, they were loving it. So they had me sort of bowling at all their top guys. And that was something that I learned from you. And I know how effective you were with that, and how you used that so well in Australian conditions. And obviously now you're, tell us what you're doing now in Australia, because I know it has a lot to do with spin bowling.
Yeah, so For the last, how long have I been in Brisbane? Probably pushing 12 years. Moved up to work at the High Performance, Cricket Australia's High Performance, so the old Cricket Academy. First moved up, I was like a scholarship coach, just sort of an apprenticeship. And yeah, it was a good year, actually. Sally and I and Lila. Lila was just born, and I think Sal was pregnant with Ted, who's now 11. So I was the scholarship coach, and then we looked after the intake. So we were in an apartment building with all the athletes, and that was like, mate, David Warner and Steve Smith and all these guys. It was like, and they had a Border Gavaskar scholarship program going on. So Virat Kohli, Bhuvaneshwar Kumar and Kalkani, is it DK?
Yeah.
They came over for, I think they were here for 2 months. So they were living in the apartment building, letting off fire alarms, cooking their curries and all that sort of stuff. And it was bloody good times. That was year one. And then after the first year, they offered me, there was no one really running their spin program. So they offered me a position to run the spin program. And so did that for probably 7 years. And that meant, you know, working across various Australian cricket teams and programs and trying to set up a spin network in Australia, which is hard because spin bowling's tough in Australia, and you only generally have one or two in a squad that to service them with someone full time is probably not looked upon as economically viable. So it was hard to set it up, and we're still struggling with it, I suppose, in Australia. And then for the last 4 years, I've been doing a little bit with Cricket Australia, but also working with Queensland Cricket with their first class team, with their spinners, and also coaching the under 17s and under 19s, which is where my passion lies. You know, I really like that development space and making a difference with people's game rather than, I think, at the top level, it's probably more just tactical and managing egos. But it's been awesome. I had a great relationship with Nathan Lyon, who, you know, had his troubles coming through when Australia was looking for that replacement for Warne, and we went through quite a few spinners who, you know, it was a good time to be working with the national team and whatnot in that time. So, you know, got to work with, you know, guys like Crazier and Horitz and various other guys that they tried in that time. And, you know, Nathan Lyon was in and out of the team, never felt as though he was being supported in the early days. You know, and I agree, you know, the selectors and the public were just, you know, looking past him and looking for another Shane Warne, which was, you know, it was rough because, it's, you know, there's probably never going to be another Shane Warne. Well, hopefully there is. Hopefully there's someone who's better. But Nath had some struggles in terms of, you know, feeling a part of that team. But now to see him and the way he plays and the way he bowls and, you know, his belief in, you know, well, he's the GOAT now. So, you know, he's definitely firmly entrenched, and to see him develop was, you know, a great experience and something that I'm proud to have been a part of.
Besides your magic touch, what was it that you felt that set Nathan apart from, say, the likes of Crazier and Horitz that you mentioned? What set the GOAT apart?
So Crazier had great shape on the ball too, but like in seam position, etc. So Crazier's best ball was, you know, really good, but he just wasn't quite repetitive, consistent enough. You know, he had a bad game in Perth, which Perth's a really hard place to bowl. If you get it slightly wrong, you know, it's a really, you can go around the park with, you know, the batters taking minimal risk. I think Nathan gets, you know, great shape on the ball, good revs on the ball, but he's become world class or the best in the world because he's managed to get his stock ball well, he doesn't bowl too much more than his stock ball. He's so in love with his stock ball that he hardly bowls or anything else. But to get that into a, you know, a really tight area and land it consistently in a tight area, that's what's made the difference to his game.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal just to see kind of his rise over the years. People always tell the story about him being a curator and whatnot, you know, just the rise from even when he first came on. He took a wicket with his first ball.
Yeah.
Somebody that's been there, but now where to see where he's gone. I mean, nobody, I don't think anybody saw that coming. We're going to stay on that track with off-spin because you weren't too bad of an off-spinner yourself, as Shady mentioned, right? And we're going to go back to 2004 where you took 17 for 137 against the USA in an Intercontinental Cup match.
Yeah.
Not to be overlooked, you also made 85 in that game as well. So you didn't have a bad outing those 4 days. Walk us through that. I mean, did you know you were on something special at the beginning of that week? Walk us through that time.
What year? 2004. So, yeah, I would have been playing pretty good cricket then. Probably the peak of my powers, I would have thought. But the game was played down in Fort Lauderdale. We turned up to the ground and the wicket was like this red clay. It looked like Roland Garros.
French Open.
They prepared for the French Open. And I was just licking my lips going, my God, this is going to turn like nobody's business. I can't remember if we won the toss or...
Your hours out that night, if you would have known, eh?
What was that?
Said you probably would have spent a few more hours out on the town if you would have known about the wicket the next day.
I can't remember where we stayed and things like that. I think we definitely went out after the game. Before the game, actually, Dan Kiesel, who was the sort of medical doctor and whatnot. He was a legend, mate. I love this guy. He was such an unbelievable guy. And he was like, have you guys ever done any, what's it called? Hypnotism. Have you ever been hypnotized? I'm like, nah, but.
I had a few tours with Dan Kiesel and he was the physio, like, buddy, that hypnotism stuff, man. Like, oh my God. That guy was an absolute legend.
Yeah. So I said, I'm willing to have a crack at that. Let's go. And I think Ash and someone else, and we like fully got into it. And he was like, "I want you to picture you leaving your body, and you're watching yourself." I'm so bad at accents, but anyway, that was my best. That was my best German Jew that I could do. I know he's not German. He's Israeli, isn't he?
Israeli, yeah.
And then studied in Germany. Yeah, what an unbelievable guy he was. But anyway, yeah, we did that, and. So I don't know if that put me in a good mindset or whatever, but I had a pretty good performance. So maybe I should have kept doing it. So I can't remember if we batted or bowled first.
I think you batted first.
Can't remember.
They wouldn't have made enough to make it's for you to allow you to make 85 if they didn't.
Yeah, right. So we batted. I opened the batting with Dylan, what was his name? Dylan, little fella from British Columbia, Indian guy. There's a bloody...
Hanny Dillon.
Yeah, mate, he was a bloody good player. He should have played more for Canada. Yeah, it was bloody hot. It was like 40 degrees and really humid. I think I spewed actually when I was batting. Came off and had a bit of a spew. And I don't think I'd been out the night before, Shady, if that's what you're alluding to.
And piss, mate. It's the American piss. It's
no good. Yeah. So, yeah, I remember. I think I retired with heat stroke.
I'm pulling up the scorecard as we speak.
Can't remember. Anyway, we got, I can't remember what we got. Maybe pushed 200, which was pretty good score on that wicket. And then we had Eason Sinatabi, is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah.
From Manitoba or somewhere like that. Alberta. Yeah. And I hadn't really seen a lot of him. He opened the bowling and went for eight in his first over, and I was like, "Nah, I've seen enough. I'm taking the ball from that end." So I gave him one over, and then I bowled from his end, and I think I bowled every over from that end for the rest of the game. Good to be the captain, but yeah, it was spinning square, and oh shit, I've got a mind blank. Who was the Danny Danaram? Danaram bowled from the. Yeah, Danaram bowled from the other end for the majority of the game also. And he did an unbelievable job. Like he wasn't a big spinner of the ball, but it was just spinning enough that he just held up an end. I think he went for less than two and over for the whole game. Whereas from my end, we were attacking and we had, you know, guys all around the bat, and Harris, the first slip, just giving it to all these West Indian mates who were playing for the US team. And yeah, it was awesome to bowl on. And it just kept, the wickets just kept falling. And yeah, it was a good experience. But I remember bowling and appealing. I remember appealing at one stage, and I got a cramp in both my calves and all up my back. And I got, it was ridiculously hot and oppressive, the conditions. But yeah, the wickets just kept falling, and yeah, it was good fun. But Jeff Barnett tells a funny story about that. Did Barney play in that game?
Barney did not play in that game.
Barney was still a youngster. He was getting a couple calf cramps at that time as well, I think.
Yeah, right. It must have been somewhere else anyway. But yeah, it was a good game. Oh, the other good thing about that game was Lance Gibbs was in the crowd. So the great West Indian off spinner. I think he must have been living in Florida. And he had played for South Australia as an overseas professional in Sheffield Shield cricket. He came up to me after the game and he had his old South Australian cricket shirt on. And I was playing for South Australia at the time. And yeah, I had a good chat with him, which was pretty cool. Yeah.
There you go.
Did he become the Canada coach like right the next day, or?
Did he? No.
Gibbs, the West.
No, they didn't. They weren't offering him for free, so we didn't take him.
So you mentioned that game that you actually opened the batting with Desmond Chumney, and Desmond Chumney was the same person that was batting with you when you scored your 100.
So Dylan wasn't even in that game.
He was in the game. You had a big partnership with him. Yeah. So he batted six.
Okay.
Yeah, he batted seven actually and made 69, where you made 84.
Did he get what he get? He get four. He got 60 odd. Yeah. He batted really well. He was a good player.
But Ash mentioned in the last show that Chumney was one of the funniest teammates that he's had. What are your memories of batting with Chumney, opening with him? Obviously, you batted with him a little bit against the West Indies in the World Cup. What are your memories of him?
He was awesome to play with. Like, played for the right reasons. Was hugely passionate. I couldn't understand a word he said, but yeah, you could tell. It was interesting batting with him. We didn't call. We just looked at each other and nodded. You know, it was just we ran between the wickets on body language. It was awesome. It was awesome. So there was no miscommunication because we could read each other's body language pretty well. The best Chumney story I've got was we played at the cricket club against, might have been Kenya. I can't even remember what the game was, but that's irrelevant. We got flogged and we were up sitting at the cricket club, so the Toronto Cricket Club, up on the top balcony. They had the changing rooms they used the function room up the top for. So we were sitting having a beer after the game, and we'd had a few, and someone walked past one of the Vic Park, or I think it must have been a Vic Park supporter or something like that. And they go, "Hey, what are you guys celebrating?" Because we got flogged, and quick as anything, the Chumney retorted with, "Oh, Nicky took a catch." meaning Nicky Eiffel, and we just fucking pissed ourselves. It was so funny. That was Nicky Eiffel, who I alluded to earlier, who, you know, if you threw one to him underarm, it was, you know, 50-50 if you'd catch it. So that was bloody funny. Yeah, Chummers was batting with me in that World Cup when I got the 100. So he'd obviously batted pretty well. You know, he must have batted for 15 overs. And yeah, he when I got my 100, there's some great photos of him giving me a big cuddle, and I remember him slapping me on the back so hard. He was bloody stoked for me. It was awesome. Yeah, good bloke.
Well, I think for him, because It was against the West Indies. He's a West Indian guy. He must have just been like, holy fuck, this guy just rocked the West Indies. Like, I can't believe this. He looked so happy for you. And like, I know how
yeah.
teammate he must have been.
Yeah. That's, and I think the commentator, I think Dean Jones was commentating. He said, you can see how happy Chumney is for his teammate. And I think that summed Desi up. And, you know, what a great example of for young people, young cricketers in cricket. You know, we fail more than we succeed. So you have to be really excited for your teammates and happy for their success. I think that's a big part of the game. Otherwise, it can be quite a lonely sport when you're having a bad trot.
Dave, you've got the commentary of that game memorized. You must have seen it a couple of times, huh?
I've probably watched it a couple more times than Shady. When he said he'd watched it 100, I was like, oh, yeah, I think I've got you covered. Because I think there's probably 250 views on the YouTube channel, Yeah.
A couple of John Davison YouTube golf tips.
Oh, that could be the new thing. I tell you what, Ted, my young fella, who's 11, his golf is going real good. He's playing off, I think his handicap's 8.7. And this coronavirus stuff has been unbelievable for his golf. So homeschooling, he gets his work done at about 1:30. He's like, I'm done, let's go to the golf course. So he would have hit golf balls every day for 2 months. And like his handicap's come in, you know, eight strokes in two months. It's been ridiculous to watch. So watch this space. Might be in the white overalls at the Masters in a few years.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, he looks like he's got the goods, man. Like for me, I think it's 8.7 balls in the fucking woods per hole.
That's an expensive game.
Is there any friendly competition between Greg Blewett's son and your son there? I know Greg Blewett's son is a.
Well, I haven't. Yeah, Bluey's son's got a little bit quiet in terms of haven't seen him on the social media as much as we used to. So hopefully he's still playing. I think you've got to get him past that stage where they, because it can be pretty boring for kids when they first start. But I think like Ted, my fella's at the age now where, you know, he's starting to win stuff and he's realizing that he's pretty good at it. So it's all of a sudden a lot more enjoyable.
Is he into cricket at all or is it just golf for him now?
Plays cricket. I'm not pushing it as much, the cricket, but, you know, I've got him doing the Virat Kohli pre-ball movement and all that sort of stuff, which we throw a lot of balls around the house, much to my wife's disappointment. But, you know, Ted's always in the living room. It's amazing watching kids and how they pick up sport these days with watching people on YouTube and things like that. I was throwing some balls to him in the living room and he like played this cover drive and like kept the elbow up and whatnot. I said, oh, that's new. Who does that? And he goes, oh, I was just watching Joe Root. He does that. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that works.
Well, I think Shady and I have been in the same boat. We've been watching YouTube highlights for the past couple of weeks nonstop now, just trying to get any sense of normality going for us. I kind of want to take this back a little bit now and kind of bring it full circle. Not sure how much you're following, obviously, the Canadian segment or not, the Canadian side today or not, but obviously we've fallen off quite a bit since the 2011 World Cup, lost ODI status, haven't really made any World Cups. We're close to the T20 World Cup last time around, lost ODI status as well. You know, what are your thoughts on what's missing? If you have been following, if not, what advice would you give some of the guys coming up now in the Canadian setup?
Yeah, it's probably a hard one for me to be an observer of one because I'm disappointed that we didn't kick on when other countries probably have. You guys would probably know the reasons more than me. The tough thing now is that, you know, you've got to get back there, minus the funding, minus the ICC funding that you'd normally have. So now it comes down to, you know, where we were in 2000 when we were first trying to qualify. It comes down to one, finding your resources. I know there's a Canadian born kid who plays cricket for Tasmania. You know, find some resources. Like I don't think you can do it on your own. I don't think you can just do it with your homegrown players. All the other countries who are doing, you know, Holland, for example, they're searching the world for, you know, first class players. And I know that there's the Cooper family, Tom Cooper's younger brother's playing, Ben, and they've got another Cooper coming through who played for Queensland under 19s last year, and I know Holland is sniffing around him. You know, I think ideally you can make it with your homegrown talent, but realistically, you know, when we qualified, we had myself come in, we had Ian Billcliffe come in, and then, you know, how much do you want it? So that I know Nitish is an unbelievable cricketer. I love watching him play. He's so talented, but he can't do it on his own. It's going to take passionate, committed cricketers who want to play on the world stage and who to do that, you know. And I think, you know, I was speaking to my kids about this generation of kids, they've had it easy, you know. They haven't had to struggle, you know, any little bit of adversity, mum and dad pick up the pieces for them. We need kids to be able to, you know, I'm sounding like a real old bloke.
That's
now.
What happens when you turn 50.
But we need people to be able to, you know, cricket is all about problem solving and getting out of pressure situations and things like that. If we haven't got people who can do that, then you're no chance. So look at the opportunity. I think if I'm a young kid in Canada, I'm going to be saying, I want to play cricket with Nitish. He's probably the best cricketer that Canada's ever produced. I want to play with him. I want to be inspired by him. He's a good bloke as well. I want to hang out with him, and then create your own dynasty. Like we had our opportunity with the ODI status and all that sort of stuff. We've lost that. Now it's up to a new group of people to grab the bull by the horns and go, you know what, let's do this. And, you know, there's a shitload of, you know, that Asian minority in Canada is like, is huge.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be a majority before too long. So you've got a shitload of people there who are passionate about the game, who do have the skills. So you're not starting from scratch. So, you know, it's there. Just got to have the right group of people to drive each other and motivate each other to achieve something.
Yeah, absolutely. The one of the points that's interesting is, you know, when you were playing for Canada, we had Billcliffe, Barney came in soon after, there's Stuart Heaney as well that played a little bit. So we had that influence coming up, and some of the guys that you grew up with at the ACA, Michael Divenuto played for Italy. You mentioned the Coopers, Van der Gugten,
yep.
Durant Jones played for PNG. You need those guys to kind of help in the system. Yep. So that's a really good, interesting take. We're going to wrap this up here, Devo. I want to thank you very much. The last segment I have is some quick fire questions for you. Very quick, easy. Answer them with the first thing.
Remember, I'm all.
Answer them with the first thing that comes to mind. If it takes a couple of seconds, yeah. Well, that's okay. And then we'll kind of leave it there. So you ready?
Yeah, let's do it. Apologies in advance.
That's quite all right. Did you have any superstitions when you were playing?
No.
Okay. Just breathing exercises.
So let me touch.
Yeah.
Can I just touch on that? Oh, no, sorry. It's quick fire. Go. No, don't worry.
Go. You can go ahead. We'll let you go ahead.
No, don't worry. Let's go.
All right. You touched on this a little bit earlier, but what were your pet peeves on the cricket field?
People not putting in a training and then seeing poor performances on the field.
Your favorite ground that you've played at?
Adelaide Oval.
Okay. Favorite lunch or tea at a ground?
Melbourne Cricket Ground. Ridiculous. Like, it's like a restaurant. It's unbelievable.
If you could choose one person to bat for your life, who would it be?
Ricky Ponting.
All right. Quick and easy. The laziest cricketer you've played with?
Oh.
Or one that didn't play up to his potential?
That's a tough one. There's been so many.
You don't have to answer. I know that's a tricky one, throwing someone under the bus there.
Yeah, I won't do that one.
The funniest teammate you had?
Funniest teammate. Trying to think of Canadians.
You don't have to.
Let's go Chumney, eh?
Chumney.
Let's go Chumney.
Chumney, that's two in a row for Chumney. We might have to get him on here. And then, okay, I've got a couple more. If you weren't a cricketer, what would you be doing?
Wow. Good question. Probably not much. No, cricket was a massive distraction for me. So, you know, I didn't finish my uni and things like that. But, you know, my life's been shaped by cricket, so it's hard to look back and say what could have been because it's all I've known.
That's completely fair. The one piece of advice you give to any young spinner?
Be resilient. Learn your craft. You're going to have more tough games than you're going to have, you know, outstanding performances. So the people who hang in there the longest and work at their craft the longest are going to make it. No one is born a good spin bowler. You have to make it. You have to do the work to become one.
Fantastic advice. And I've got one last one. This one might be a little bit tricky for you. If you could trade your World Cup century and your 17 wickets record in order to play one test match for Australia, would you do it?
In a heartbeat.
There you go. The baggy green reigns supreme.
Yeah. As long as it was on a spinning wicket.
Fantastic.
Against the West Indies, not in India because they play it too well.
Fort Lauderdale against the West Indies.
Yeah, let's do it.
Fantastic. JD, as the Canadians know you, Davo, as the Australians know you, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure for the both of us. I hope you enjoyed yourself as well, and hopefully we can get you on again. You could be a recurring guest on the podcast.
Good on you, boys. Great to have a chat and good to reminisce about some old times.
Thanks, JD. We'll talk soon, brother. Thanks for doing this for us, man.
No problem, Shady. Good on you, pal. Good job, boys. I like it. Good luck with it all.
And now, a word from our sponsors.
How does your bat feel in your hand, boys? Little crack? Little toe nick? Handle needs repair? Contact Samir at the Bat Clinic, 416-723-8589. Or DM on Instagram at the Bat Clinic. Use our promo code, Dropped Again, for 10% off all services. I just got my new sticks, boys. Can't wait for the season to get going.
Well, there you have it. What an interview. I was super excited going into it, and I loved the way it turned out. So hopefully you guys all did too. Shady, what'd you think?
Yeah, man. Davo, he brings the fire, man. Hopefully he'll come back on. Like, it's just a small glimpse of those times, but obviously into a huge moment in what was the history of Canada cricket, put us on the map. Obviously, you heard all about it. Those sixes were raining. Oh, just goosebumps kind of still with that interview, man. It was crazy.
You know what's crazy is we got to interview him maybe a little bit later on in the day. He talked super slow. I don't know if it's once you turn 50, you talk super slow or what's going on, but I don't think you guys can hear it because I did a hell of a job editing. I just want to put that out there. But I had to cut out a lot of the pauses in that interview.
And I thought I was like ripped, right? I thought I smoked a huge dude in the morning. I can't even imagine what the size of the one Dabo probably fucking ripped.
So the first thing I want to talk about is this interview. I've had these feelings was the fact that when he scored his 100, and you mentioned earlier that you knew some of these stories. I had no idea. So when he talked about his 100, the story going into all that, and then he scores his 100, world record 100, and he tucks his helmet under his arm. And I've seen this video hundreds of times, right? And I've never picked this up, but now looking it over, he tucks this helmet under his arm and is almost ashamed and just disrespected by Canada and the Canadian Cricket Association so much at this time that he doesn't even want to celebrate that he scored 100 for Canada. He celebrated his 100 for John Davison. You can't argue with that.
Yeah, well, Chumney did all the celebrating for him. Chumney makes a mean, like this carrot drink thing with a Guinness in it. I remember Chumney used to tell me, like, you gotta drink this juice. And the way he used to say it, and like, oh, man. Anyway, but he looked like he was fucking loving it. And yeah, I guess a stance for like what had happened and Jeff Thomas and the argument with Gus Logie and the accusations and stuff. And like, man, I know, like, Dave Odo, it was all about cricket. It was all about performance. It was all about cricket, right? Like, it was a bunch of emotions that were bubbling and brewing for a long time. And that was the way that he wanted to sort of show it. And he did by doing that. And you know what? I never knew about that either. So good for him. Like, you can do whatever you want. Score 100. At that time, it was a world's fastest 100. Like, fucking suck on that, Canada Cricket Association.
And the West Indies Cricket Board. The other thing is, he wasn't wrong, right? You want your best 11. Sanjay Tirasingham at 80% at that time is better then your next option, Sanjay, plays.
Yeah, but that's the selection is always subjective, right? So in the eyes of Gus Logie and whoever else was picking that team, they didn't think so. So like you always wonder, like everyone has their opinion. So when it's your job to select teams, and like if you look at Canada cricket over the last however long you've looked at Canada cricket and who the selectors are, I can't even think about how many there have been, first of all. Second of all, how many of them never played any kind of high level cricket? You know, so it's like, you know, how do you know in their eyes, he wasn't the best player, and these guys' eyes, they were. And whose eyes do you want to take? Maybe the guy who plays first class cricket in Australia, and the other guys in the team, and the captain who wanted to pick, obviously, Sanjay. But that's the problem when you bring in a coach like 2 weeks before the World Cup, and he obviously has his own ideas and agendas, and maybe he was under the pump from the West Indies Cricket Board to play more of the West Indian guys. Like, I don't know. You never know, right? You never know what's going on with that. But clearly, I know the players back then and what was up, and Sanjay was like Ash talked about Sanjay being like one of the best bowlers he's ever wicket-keeped. Is that right? Wicket-keeped.
Yeah, I think that's spot on.
So there you go. So, I mean, but he obviously used that fuel and boom.
So the thing is, and this is an interesting, I don't know the truth to this. And it's funny, we might have to ask Sanjay himself. So they played Sri Lanka in the game before they played the West Indies. And they were bowled out for 36. When Sri Lanka was chasing, Canada only took one wicket. And that wicket was taken by Sanjay Thirasingam. He got Sanat Jayasuriya out. And I feel like there's a documentary on this somewhere, that there was a documentary made on the Canadian cricket team going to the 2003 World Cup. And Sanjay celebrated after the game in the locker room. He celebrated his wicket of Sanat Jayasuriya in the locker room, even though they just got demolished. The story is that Cricket Canada actually either released him or suspended him after that game. And I think that might have a huge part to play in why he didn't play in that game against the West Indies. It wasn't the back injury. It was the fact that he celebrated this wicket after the game.
That's interesting. That's interesting, man. You think about a guy who, I guess his hero probably would have been Sanat. Sanjay was a youngster. Well, probably not too much younger than Sanat, but in the 96 World Cup, Sri Lanka won the 96 World Cup, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's like a hero for him, and you get your hero out and you're all out for 36. Like, man, if you're all out for 36, boys, like just get into the beers, like just like kind of forget about it. I mean, it's one of those things, like, and it was a world record too, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. Like, you don't need any more negative attention or negative dramas around that sort of scenario. And you know the personality of a guy like Sanjay, so they probably didn't even know, right? Whoever reported that probably didn't even know his personality. And for me, that's just such a huge thing for Canada cricket. Like, I know I was one of them. There's, again, I talked about it, right? They probably didn't even know the guy's personality. They didn't know his character. So many people are different, right? He's from a different part of the world. He goes about things different. So that would be a shame if that was the case. But also, you know, you'd probably hate to be the guy if he said it like when you're walking off the field type thing, and he's smiling and laughing. It's embarrassing. And I know JD, if I know JD and them well, like I know them well, they would have been pretty pissed about being embarrassed by Sri Lanka or any team, but with that score. And so, interesting, man. It'd be interesting to hear probably from Sanjay himself. I know he puts a lot into youth cricket. He does a fantastic job. I think he has his own indoor cricket center. We'll probably have to get him to sponsor the podcast. But shout outs to him anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like, and listeners, if this is real, if I'm not making this up, there is a documentary out there on Canada going to the 2003 World Cup. It is out there. If you know it, if you have it, send it to us, because I feel like this is real. I didn't dream this. I watched a documentary, I believe it was on CBC, where the cameras followed the Canadian national team to the 2003 World Cup. And I distinctly remember Sanjay celebrating this wicket, and they had cameras on him in the change room. I might be the only one that's ever seen this.
I think you're talking about Sidney Crosby when Canada won the gold medal in Vancouver. I'll have to ask my buddy Dory Krinsky about that, because Dory Krinsky, just one of the supporters, South African guy, I think in the last week, he's called me about five times and told me about maybe 50 stories. So I don't know if I'm going to start to use his stories. I think he wants to come on to the show, but I don't know. He might have to also sponsor the podcast. So whatever, man. There's plenty of stories I'm sure we'll hear going forward even about that, and you never know what you're going to hear through different guys. But, you know, when you talk about fitness and what was going on at that time, these guys were lucky to have the one and only Dan Kiesel. So just Dave-O talking about Dan Kiesel, man, just brings up the memory. So now that I think about it, I used to love, because I had a rotator cuff problem. I had a torn rotator cuff and I was playing whatever. And Dan, whenever I could, and these big guys were not getting treated, I would just go, because like I got on with him so well. He was such a nice guy. He had his hypnotism thing that he would do, right? So like we'd always be like laying down and he would have this thing where he's like, "You're feeling comfortable, relaxed, and eased. All of your problems are removing themselves from your body. You're feeling comfortable, relaxed, and eased." I could knock some of you motherfuckers out with hypnotism. I'll tell you that right now, because Kiesel taught me the way. So like that stuff, I think, did Ash talk about that too? Like the hypnotism stuff? Like, or did?
No.
Anyway, so Kiesel was the man, and he was the physio for the Pakistan team back in the day. And he was like, yeah, the guy, like the white dude in the Pakistan camp in the 92 World Cup running on the field and stuff like that. And he had this amazing character, man. Like we'd be doing fitness and like he had this thing where like, so he'd always finish off with like abs. So it's just like different like abs and like awesome ab exercise. Like this guy was the man. He knew some shit. So we're doing, you know, ab exercises, and then you'd always, and another 10. And you'd have to go with another 10, and you'd be like, and you know, 3, 2, and you'd be dying, and another 10. And you'd go, whatever, boom, boom, boom. You're slacking around, like a lot of the guys, but they couldn't even do 10 sit-ups, 10 crunches, man. But he'd go around, he'd slap, like he had this thing, he used to slap you on the ass, right? So he'd slap you on the ass, like, up, and he'd slap you on the ass, like, come on, more paprika. Paprika. So, oh, buddy, just amazing, man. Like, what a guy that guy was. And the treatments that this guy used to give, like, oh, man, unbelievable treatments. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was an unbelievable physio. He was getting older at that time, too. And it was funny because like, he was getting on in age, man. He was getting on in age. And, like, he was responsible for everybody's, like, pills and stuff before the games or whatever, right? So, I don't know, man, if we were getting the right pills for anti-inflammatories, or maybe it was promoting inflammation, because you know, a lot of the guys were always on the injury table. But that's what it is, playing cricket at a high level in some of these countries where it's either super cold or scorching hot.
Nah, dude, he definitely knew his shit. He was like a surgeon. He wasn't a physio, like he was a legit doctor, and he was like a surgeon. And I remember these stories because when I had my back injury, I had to go to his house to get treated, and he had all his degrees and everything up there.
He didn't even have to, like when he did surgery, they probably didn't even have to use like the anesthesia. He just hypnotized you. You're feeling comfortable. And next thing you know, you're out and your fucking kidney's coming out. Oh man.
And legit, he knew everything. The one story that I remember about Dan was, I think it was Umar Bhatti against the Netherlands up in King City. While fielding or while batting, he got hit in the thumb. And his thumb looked, it was like three thumbs put together. And it was swollen. It was definitely broken. But they were down to their last wicket. Canada was down to their last wicket. And Umar had to go out and bat. And Dan stuck a needle straight into his thumb, like under his nail. Straight in to drain some of the blood and also to freeze his thumb. So if you remember Graham Smith batting against Australia when Mitchell Johnson was bowling, he had it all taped up. He was wearing like this huge glove and went out and bat against the Netherlands. I can't remember what happened after that, but I just remember Dan literally two people holding Omar's hand and Dan sticking a needle straight into his thumb.
Who was holding on to Omar's hair? Shout out my man, Umar Bhatti. He's like a quiet, he's a quiet guy. He's been away from the cricket scene for a while, but man, that guy also amazing stories. And he was one of the younger guys sort of in the squad at that time and came up in Canada cricket and had a very, very successful career. And he was tough, man. He was tough. Like, I got to give it to him. I played with him on tours and stuff, and he was tough, and he did the job, man. But I loved his hair. I loved the way his hair just used to bounce up and down as he ran in, like Wazim Akram left arm over. Man.
I'm trying to get my hair to that level right now. That's what I've been doing during quarantine, is growing my hair and trying to get to that level. But the thing with Umar was he always wrote, like, in the league in club cricket, you wouldn't be like he's not a world beater. But then when he went and played for Canada, it was like he took it to another level and his game just went up 10x. And he was just so good for Canada. His record is great for Canada. So my cats are running around. It's 9 p.m. They need to get fed. So let's wrap up this episode here. I want to thank everybody for listening. The support has been great so far. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Find us on Instagram. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter. We are at Dropped Again. Thank you for another great episode. And we look forward to speaking to you next week. Adios.
Peace.